This episode of Navarra Live is brought to you by listeners like you. Thank you.
Welcome to Navarra Live. I'm Michael Walker. And on this Monday evening, I'm joined by Ash Sarkar.
I'm very well. I'm so happy to be reunited with you. My Mondays are livable again.
The only way that any sane person would start the week is with me. I do think on a Monday evening, I'm very glad to start my week with you too. We have some big stories tonight. So coming up later, and we'll be looking at the aftermath of the Moscow terror attack that has killed at least 130 people. On a lighter note, a salary of £100,000 is apparently not a lot of money, according to the Chancellor of the Exchequer. And China and Russia are being blamed for memes about Kate Middleton. That's how they're trying to undermine the fabric of our society, according to the Telegraph and potentially even the British security services. First, though, some significant updates on the situation in Gaza. The United Nations Security Council has for the first time passed a resolution demanding an immediate ceasefire in Gaza. This was the moment that 14 of the 15 members of the Security Council voted in favour of the resolution. The only country not to vote in favour of it was the United States. But significantly, they did break with their previous form.
Those against. Abstention.
The vote marks the first time that the US hasn't vetoed peace in Gaza, except on their own failed draft resolution last week. Their abstention means that the text will now be adopted by the UN. Brought to the Council by a coalition of countries, the resolution demands this: an immediate ceasefire for the month of Ramadan, respected by all parties, leading to a permanent, sustainable ceasefire, and also demands the immediate and unconditional release of all hostages, as well as ensuring humanitarian access to address their medical and other humanitarian needs, and further demands that the parties comply with their obligations under international law in relation to all persons they detain. That phrase, and also demands, so and also demands, that to me suggests that the immediate ceasefire and the release of the hostages should be taken as two independent commands from the Security Council, i.e. one should not be conditional on the other. But the United States ambassador to the UN has tried to frame it otherwise.
Today, this council spoke out in support of the ongoing diplomatic efforts led by the United States, Qatar, Egypt, to bring about an immediate and sustainable ceasefire, secure the immediate release of all hostages, and help alleviate the tremendous suffering of Palestinian civilians in Gaza who are in dire need of protection and life-saving humanitarian assistance. The United States fully supports these critical objectives. In fact, they were the foundation of the resolution we put forward last week, a resolution that Russia and China vetoed. But colleagues, the United States' support for these objectives is not simply rhetorical. We're working around the clock to make them real on the ground through diplomacy, because we know that it is through only through diplomacy that we can push this agenda forward. We're getting closer to a deal for an immediate ceasefire with the release of all hostages, but we're not there yet. Now, let's be clear. A ceasefire could have come about months ago if Hamas had been willing to release hostages. Months ago. Instead, Hamas continues to stand in the way of peace.
Now, it seems a bit cheeky to say that this motion, which the United States abstained on, is just an endorsement of the failed mediation process that the United States has been leading, right? Oh, we don't really like this motion, but by the way, now you've passed it, all you're doing is endorsing our negotiation processes, which haven't worked. And we talked about this a lot. The reason they haven't worked is because Israel has as its conditions, we want you to release all the hostages, then we'll have a very short ceasefire, and then we'll destroy you, which are not terms that an organization is going to accept, right? This is not a moral statement. I don't think this is a justification for keeping people hostage, but you can't say we're going to put this incredibly unreasonable demand on you and say that we get to fight this war until then. This is collective punishment. If you're saying we are going to keep killing thousands and thousands and thousands of people until you, this small organization, releases a couple hundred hostages, that is collective punishment. So having one contingent on the other is not you know, within international law is not reasonable. That's the American interpretation of this resolution, which has been passed. Other countries have different ones. So this was the Chinese ambassador who made it clear that they had a very different interpretation to the United States.
Last Friday, the Security Council voted on the other draft resolution proposed by the United States on the situation in Gaza. China, together with Algeria and Russia, voted against it. A comparison of the two drafts shows the differences. The current draft is unequivocal and correct in its direction, demanding an immediate ceasefire, while the previous one has been evasive and ambiguous. The current draft demands an unconditional ceasefire, while the previous one has set preconditions for ceasefire. Security Council resolutions are binding. We call on the parties concerned to fulfill their obligations under the United Nations Charter and to take due action as required by the resolution. We expect the state with significant influence to play a positive role on the party concerned, including by using all necessary and effective means at their disposal to support the implementation of the resolution. To this end, all harm to civilians must cease immediately.
So it's interesting that the Chinese ambassador sort of specifically said UN resolutions by the Security Council are binding. Now, I was a bit confused about this today because the American ambassador, before the Chinese ambassador had said that, explicitly said this is a non-binding resolution. So it was confusing to me how you could have these, you know, these two diplomats say completely opposite things. I put it out on Twitter today. Apparently there is some ambiguity. So this was a resolution which was passed under a chapter which doesn't then oblige states to sort of use any means necessary to enforce it. But at the same time, it's not purely sort of advisory because there was an International Court of Justice ruling in the 1970s which sort of implied that anything passed by the Security Council is legally binding, even if there is not an obligation for states to very proactively enforce that. Of course, there you've got two very different interpretations of the Security Council resolution. And a comparison of the speeches between the Chinese and American ambassadors show that Washington still sees its job as Israel's representative on the Security Council, giving all of Israel's talking points. That's not good enough for Netanyahu, though. In response to the American abstention, Netanyahu has cancelled an Israeli delegation's planned visit to Washington, blaming the US's, quote, change in stance. Now, the White House says they have not been informed of any planned changes. But Itamar Ben-Gvir, so one of the most extreme members of the Israeli cabinet, although national security minister, not a fringe figure, he has, as you would imagine, said that this proves the UN is anti-Semitic. He said it proves that President Biden does not put the victory of Israel and the free world over terrorism at the top of his priorities. And then he says, precisely after this decision, we must increase the intensity of the war and continue striving with all our might at any cost to defeat Hamas. So the response from Ben-Gvir, the National Security Minister of Israel, is to say that this UN resolution demanding a ceasefire actually is a reason why we should intensify our genocidal war on Gaza. Ash, how significant do you think this UN resolution is?
I think what it indicates is a shifting of the US's position and what it is willing to do and not do in terms of diplomatic cover in this later period of what Israel calls a war, what the rest of the world is calling a genocide. So I think if this had happened just a couple of months ago, you would have seen the US exercising its veto power in the Security Council, as it has done when there have been previous ceasefire motions proposed. The UK also had been voting against ceasefire motions in the UN. And I think what this boils down to is the intransigence of Netanyahu's government over the proposed ground invasion of Rafah. For the US, they said this is a red line, we can't support it. Netanyahu very bullishly has said, we will absolutely go ahead with sending troops into Rafah, which would likely come after a period of even more intense bombardment of an area where over a million Palestinians are sheltering, having fled from other parts of the Gaza Strip. So I would say that this is a significant movement from the US. It won't necessarily change what Netanyahu is going to do. The coalition that he has holding up his government is reliant on support from far-right figures such as Itamar Ben-Gvir, such as Bezalel Smotrich, and he's got to keep them on side. They absolutely want to see a ground invasion of Rafah, and I think that Netanyahu will try to prolong his political career by acquiescing. What changes the domestic political calculation is what figures outside of Netanyahu's war cabinet are thinking and saying. So what's quite interesting is that after Netanyahu pulled out of this planned Washington visit, is Yair Lapid, who of course himself previously was head of an Israeli government, said, well, these are the actions of a man who is out of control. And I think that that phrasing shows you the way in which it's being interpreted in terms of Israeli politics. We're not talking about any degree of introspection about the tremendous loss of life in Gaza. We're certainly not talking about any sudden pang of conscience about humanizing the Palestinians. What this is about is, does Netanyahu look weak? Is he going to be able to hold his government together? And I think there will be attempts from, you know, the center right of Israeli politics to say, well, look, he's alienating the Americans. This puts Israeli interests at risk. This is a man who's out of control and whose judgment is impaired. So that's one way in which I think this can play out domestically. I do, however, think that Netanyahu's instincts have shown that he'll side with the far right elements of his cabinet and pin his political survival on them rather than necessarily, you know, moderating his stance somewhat and saying that the release of the hostages is the primary objective here and not, as he calls it, the destruction, which we all know is simply code for the destruction of the Gaza Strip and the displacement of Palestinians who live there.
As I said, I was talking earlier about sort of the legal debate that I'm sure we'll see about whether saying "and also demands the release of the hostages" sort of implies that they are two separate demands and Israel must comply with a ceasefire even if the hostages aren't released. There'll be lawyers saying that they are sort of connected. There'll be lawyers saying they aren't connected. My worry is that any sliver of ambiguity means that the United States and the Israelis will sort of, they'll just say, well, we're going for our favorite interpretation. And obviously in these situations, to a large degree, might does make right. And unless the Americans are going to stop Israel continuing its genocidal war, Israel will continue its genocidal war. By the way, I wish more people around the world sort of watched all the interventions from all of the ambassadors. I have to admit, I haven't really done it much before this conflict, and there have been these high-profile debates. But it's so interesting seeing what everyone comes up with. Now, of course, it's not, you know, I don't think any of them are speaking necessarily sort of from the heart or with pure moral clarity. But it's very interesting to see the very different interpretations from America, Russia, China, and then some of the smaller states who've been elected onto the Security Council. So I do recommend checking that out. Of course, whatever the implications of today's UN resolution, it won't have come soon enough for the 32,000 Palestinians already killed by Israel in Gaza. The territory is on the brink of famine and conditions look set to worsen. That's because an Israeli official has confirmed that Israel will stop working with UNRWA in Gaza. So UNRWA is the largest humanitarian agency operating in Gaza, responsible for distributing food and medical aid, as well as operating schools, hospitals, and refugee centers. An Israeli spokesperson told Reuters this: UNRWA are part of the problem and we will now stop working with them. We are actively phasing out the use of UNRWA because they perpetuate the conflict rather than try and alleviate the conflict. Now, that announcement from Israel followed an earlier one barring UNRWA from delivering food to northern Gaza, where the risk of starvation is currently highest. This was UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres on that ban.
The decision not to allow UNRWA's convoys to go to northern Gaza, where we have a dramatic starvation situation, is totally unacceptable. And those that took that decision must assume the responsibility facing history of the consequences of the decision in relation to the dramatic situation of the people in northern Gaza, where, as I mentioned, we have already children dying of hunger.
The ban on UNRWA follows a concerted effort by Israel to discredit the agency. In January, they accused workers for the relief organization of aiding Hamas. On October the 7th, Israel presented those claims on the same day that the International Court of Justice found it plausible that the country was committing genocide in Gaza. It led to several countries, including the US and UK, pulling their funding to the agency. So far, none of those claims have stood up to scrutiny, but getting UNRWA out of Gaza is an effective way of ramping up the pressure on Palestinians to leave Gaza. And it's potentially part of a larger strategy to make the Strip unlivable for Palestinians. Now, the Grey Zone has released a new documentary focused on the settlers whose almost daily protests block humanitarian aid from entering Gaza. One IDF soldier explained how UN infrastructure in Gaza was being targeted by the military.
We've been training for 1 month and then we got inside Gaza. And then we've been there for 2 months. My unit was in charge of explosions. We blew up houses of terrorists, mosque, UN offices. I remember we got into some UN office that was in charge of helping families in Gaza that was affected by the war, and we destroyed it.
Wow, that last sentence, UN offices that were in charge of, you know, giving support to families displaced by the war, we destroyed it. Of course, universities, medical centers, schools, and thousands of homes, tens of thousands of homes, have been destroyed in Gaza, not to mention roads, businesses, and other critical infrastructure. But there are plans afoot to rebuild it. The Grey Zone also spoke to one settler about the future of Gaza.
We love the Gaza Strip. We can't just take a whole strip of land and say Israelis can't live there. That doesn't make sense. This is our sovereign state.
Would you live there?
Of course.
By the beach?
Oh, for sure. Yes, my husband's also talking about building. He has a yeshiva, a Talmudic institute here. So building a branch. In Gaza. We have lists already about 500 families that are willing, on the drop of a hat, to just move into, we have north, central, and south Gaza, and people are going to start building towns. We have names of the towns, we have where we're building them. It's already being planned, and we have people signed up. You can't leave it without Jews in the Gaza Strip. It's too big a piece of land, it's too important for us to let it become Hamas town, as we call it, full of terrorists.
You can't have this piece of land without us living there. Ash, to call it an entitled attitude is a bit of an understatement, isn't it? I mean, how would you respond to those two clips we've just seen?
I think it was really important to show those two clips together in the way that you just did, because I think it shows you what's really going on here. On the one hand, what you've got is a concerted military effort to destroy the institutions which allow Palestinians to live in the Gaza Strip. So yes, it's right that we're talking about collective punishment. Yes, it's right that we're talking about indiscriminate bombing. But in a way, the word indiscriminate doesn't do justice to what's actually going on, which is the targeted destruction of schools, of UN infrastructure, of food infrastructure, and those things which would allow the Palestinians, if they were left in the Gaza Strip after a long-term ceasefire, to be able to rebuild their lives. So the idea isn't just to wipe out tens of thousands of Palestinian civilians in the here and now. It's also about dramatically curtailing their ability to live, survive, or thrive in the Gaza Strip. Now, that isn't just to do with, I think, a very deep racism and dehumanization of Palestinians, though, of course, that's a driving factor for the kind of wanton destruction that we see. It's purposeful, and that purpose is the expansion of Israel and the settlement of Israeli Jews into Palestinian territory. Things are not two separate political issues. They are part of the same project, which is settler colonialism. And I think that that's the thing which, in particular, liberals in the West have been so reluctant to examine, because that settler colonial project is much older than October 7th. It's much older than 1967 and the illegal settlements which breach those borders. It goes back to, I think, what Israel is as a state. You can't have a Jewish majority state plonked on top of an Arab majority territory without ethnic cleansing. You simply can't have that. And that was, I think, built in to the Zionist settler project even before 1948. And I think it's a legitimate position to say, okay, that was a grave injustice of the past, but what you're having to do now is negotiate a solution which takes into account the fact that people now live here, and the solution to ethnic cleansing is not more ethnic cleansing. That's a legitimate position. But I don't think you can explain what you're seeing. And that sense of perfect certainty being articulated by a woman who quite clearly has either a New York or a New Jersey accent, it's part of an ideology which is foundational to the state of Israel. I think it goes bone and marrow deep.
Let's go straight on to our next story. Four suspects have appeared in a Moscow court charged with killing over 130 concertgoers in a terrorist attack on Friday. Just after 8 o'clock local time, attackers armed with automatic weapons and incendiary devices stormed the Crocus City Concert Hall, located on the outskirts of Moscow. Dressed in camouflage fatigues, they opened fire on people waiting to see a rock band, shooting for over an hour. Panicked concertgoers tried to hide between tables and pillars, with others breaking windows to escape. According to witnesses, the attackers then launched a Molotov cocktail, setting the venue alight before fleeing the scene. A SWAT team was dispatched but failed to accost the terrorists. More than 70 ambulances arrived at the scene to assist the injured. So far, at least 137 people have been confirmed killed, with that number likely to rise, and nearly 200 people were injured. An offshoot of Islamic State called ISIS-K has claimed responsibility for the assault, releasing this footage shot by the gunman. "Bring the machine gun, kill them and have no mercy," says one of the men in the video. Another says, "The infidels will be defeated, God willing, God is great." It's the deadliest attack ever claimed by the group in Europe, and Russia says that in total, 11 people have been detained in connection with the attack. The four men appearing in court today have been identified as citizens of Tajikistan, a former Soviet state in Central Asia. Russian police say the suspects were caught several hundred kilometers from Moscow, about 150 kilometers from the border with Ukraine. That was following a manhunt. And they appear to have undergone brutal treatment at the hands of the Russian authorities. One of the suspects, pictured in the top right here, appeared in court with a large bandage on one side of his face. A video played on Russian media over the weekend showed how Russian security forces had removed part of his ear after capturing him before forcing it into his mouth. Another suspect, pictured on the bottom right, was brought to the dock in a wheelchair, appearing barely conscious in court. The men are alleged to belong to the group Islamic State in Khorasan, or ISIS-K, which is active in Afghanistan, Pakistan, and Iran. In January this year, the group claimed responsibility for a pair of bombings in Iran, which killed scores of people taking part in memorial services for former General Qasem Soleimani. And in Afghanistan, the Taliban have been fighting ISIS-K after it killed 170 civilians and 13 US service personnel in a bombing attack in 2021. ISIS-K have also conducted cross-border attacks against Pakistan. But the group has also expressed anti-Russian sentiment, opposing the country for its support of Assad in Syria, for its interventions in Chechnya in the 1990s, and even for the Soviet invasion of Afghanistan. And Western intelligence agencies at least appear to have had some warning of a possible attack on Russian territory. On March the 7th, the US Embassy in Moscow posted this. So avoid large gatherings over the next 48 hours, it warns. And it advises US citizens to avoid large gatherings, including concerts, because of reports that extremists have imminent plans to target them. So in a White House briefing after the Moscow attack, White House National Security Advisor John Kirby was asked about that warning.
Did the US have prior knowledge of this attack in Moscow, given that the US embassy had issued warning beforehand?
I'm not aware of any advance knowledge that we had of this terrible attack.
On March 8th, the embassy warns of imminent attack in Moscow by extremists.
Yeah, I think that I'll let the State Department speak to that, I think, but I don't think that was related to this specific attack.
While European and American intelligence agencies have ascribed the attack to ISIS-K, Russian officials have a different account, pointing the finger at Ukraine. Writing on Telegram, a Russian foreign ministry spokesperson said this, "I wish the US could have solved the assassination of their own President Kennedy so quickly. But no, for more than 60 years, they have not been able to find out who killed him after all. Or maybe that was ISIS too. Until the investigation into the terrorist attack at Crocus City Hall is completed, any phrase from Washington exonerating Kyiv should be considered as evidence. After all, the financing of terrorist activities of the Kyiv organized criminal group by the American Liberal Democrats and participation in the corrupt schemes of the Biden family have been going on for many years." Russian President Vladimir Putin has not so far directly blamed Ukraine for the attack, but he has refused to lay blame with ISIS-K and said this in an address to the nation.
All four perpetrators of the terrorist act who shot and killed people have been detained. They were traveling towards Ukraine, where, according to preliminary data, a window had been prepared for them on the Ukrainian side to cross the state border.
Putin also referred to the attackers as Nazis. That's the moniker he often uses to describe the government in Ukraine. Earlier today, I spoke to Anatol Levin. He's an expert in security policy based in Washington, D.C., and director of the Eurasia Program at the Quincy Institute for Responsible Statescraft. Now, I began by asking him how we should understand ISIS 5 years after the defeat of the caliphate in Iraq and Syria.
ISIS was defeated as as an army, because after all, remember, ISIS ruled large parts of Syria and the whole of northern Iraq for several years. That was defeated. The Islamic State of the Levant was defeated and crushed. But that doesn't mean that ISIS as a terrorist movement was crushed. I mean, as we have seen, it is remarkably difficult to completely eliminate terrorist groups because, of course, they don't operate on the basis of large identifiable armed forces. They're constantly developing new ways of disguising themselves, and they are rooted in particular populations and sections of populations across the world. So the terrorist threat, as we have seen, remains a constant. I mean, we know that in Britain as well. After the July bombings in London, the security services, did greatly increase their surveillance and guard against Islamist terrorist groups, but that didn't prevent Manchester a few years later.
ISIS-K have claimed it. They've released footage of them doing it. Putin still doesn't seem to want to speak about ISIS-K, so he sort of hasn't talked about the origins so much of this attack. All he has said is that it seemed as if they were trying to escape to Ukraine, and he suggested that there were sort of people in Ukraine ready to welcome them. I mean, what do you make of how sort of Putin has responded to these attacks?
Well, first of all, I don't think there can be any doubt whatsoever that ISIS was Islamic State of Khorasan was responsible. They've claimed responsibility, as you say. They've shown footage, and anyway, this is completely according to their playbook. Putin, of course, wants to tie this into the war with Ukraine, because otherwise, I mean, it does suggest that he's got his priorities wrong as far as real Russian security is concerned. This is also a way of distracting attention from what was clearly a massive failure on the part of the Russian security services, particularly given that they were warned by the United States. Now, that said, assuming that these Tajiks who've been arrested are the actual perpetrators, the fact that they were heading south from Moscow towards Ukraine is odd. That doesn't mean that the Ukrainian authorities were involved in some way, but it does look as if the terrorists themselves, if these Tajiks were responsible, were probably aiming to try to get across the border into Ukraine, because otherwise their movement in that general direction doesn't make any sense at all. So there are, you know, a lot of still unanswered questions about this. The problem is, of course, that nothing that these men say or confess to can now be relied on. I think from, you know, what we've seen of their condition, any of us would probably admit to anything now. It doesn't mean that it's true.
That's an interesting sort of angle, because lots of people have obviously been talking about the torture of these suspects. And one would presume that maybe their interrogators will be encouraging them to in some way implicate Ukraine in all of this, because that's clearly what Vladimir Putin is very keen to do. And I suppose my question to you, if he manages to get some sort of confession under duress from these suspects, I mean, is there any possibility that the Russian public are actually going to buy that this is a sort of Ukrainian issue and not one about Islamists being annoyed at Putin for getting involved in Syria and before that in Chechnya?
Many no doubt will be if this line is pushed hard enough. Of course, it will also depend on whether Russia will come up with any evidence of Ukrainian involvement, which doesn't depend simply on the confessions of these suspects. I mean, look, one can't absolutely rule out a Ukrainian role. I mean, obviously, Ukraine would have a strong motive to make as much trouble for Russia as possible, and also to discredit Putin and the Russian security services. But we would need some very firm evidence that this is the case. On that score, by the way, I should also say that the line being peddled by parts of the Russian opposition and taken up, you know, pretty shamefully by certain Western commentators, only some, I'm happy to say, that this attack was the work of the Russian security services is also at present absolutely disgraceful and has no evidence behind it. If people are going to say things like this on either side, they need to have some real evidence to back it up. Otherwise, we're just back in the crazy mirror world of conspiracy theories.
What should we make of the fact that the Americans, you know, were quite open that they had this intelligence, and it seems like it was very good intelligence? Obviously, they said the attack was going to be in 38 hours. It was actually within 2 weeks. So, but that's not, that's still very good intelligence, right? And they did tell the Russians, and that might suggest that, you know, the Americans are still willing to work with the Russians. Obviously, Vladimir Putin wants to present the war with Ukraine as an existential battle between Russia and the West. But here you've got the Americans basically doing the Russians a favor and saying, you know, you're at risk of a terrorist attack. And then Putin ignores them and the attack happens. What does that tell us about that relationship?
Putin didn't completely ignore them. He did order the Russian, domestic security forces onto higher alert. But clearly, I mean, there was a massive failure somewhere along the line, especially given that this happened in Moscow. Then again, you know, Russia is a big country. You can't protect everywhere. But given, you know, that the attack in many ways mimicked what had happened at a, you know, notorious terrorist attack on a Russian theater more than 20 years ago now, the fact that the Russian security forces were so badly prepared is, you know, from a Russian point of view, quite quite shocking. I mean, certain contacts continue, and there is an awareness, I think, on both sides, obviously in the Russian anti-terrorism forces as well, that, you know, there are still common enemies. I mean, there can hardly be not be such an awareness, because after all, several terrorist attacks in the West, including the bombing attack on the Boston Marathon, were carried out by former Russian citizens, by Chechens and others. So the common threat is obvious. I am told, but I can't confirm this, that under the surface, Russia has still been passing on tips about terrorism to the United States, you know, in the expectation that they will receive tips in return.
Let's go straight on to our next story. Britain has a funny relationship to money. On the one hand, people on minimum wage or measly benefits are frequently told they just need to learn to budget.
The typical user of food bank is not someone that's languishing in poverty. It's someone who has a cash flow problem episodically. Oh. No, it's true.
There's not this massive use for food banks in this country. We've got generation after generation who cannot cook properly. They can't cook a meal from scratch. They cannot budget. The challenge is there.
So people on low incomes don't need handouts. They just need to budget. Meanwhile, people on incomes four times higher than the minimum wage are convinced they don't have a mere pound to spare. This was an infamous episode of Question Time in the run-up to Britain's last general election.
I've read your policy. It's above £80,000. And I am nowhere near in the top 5%, let me tell you. I'm not even in the top 50%.
And that's why we're not going to increase your income tax. And
So hang on, let's just be clear. So you're suggesting you would raise income tax on those earning over £80,000. You're saying that would affect you because you earn over that sum?
Yes.
So you earn over £80,000?
Yes, and I'm not in the top 5%. Yes,
you are. I think that is the top 5%, isn't it?
I'm not.
Sorry. I've seen that so many times before, but just like, he's so annoyed that anyone would think he's not in the top 5%. He even thinks he's not in the top 50%. So the median annual wage in 2019 for full-time employees was 30 grand, right? And it would have been even lower if you included those working part-time. Yeah, that man on 80 grand thought he was in the bottom half of earners, and he was absolutely outraged and indignant when anyone suggested he wasn't. So, how do Britons get such a poor understanding of how their wages compare to others? And how do those on high salaries maintain the illusion that they are struggling compared to people on much lower incomes than themselves? Well, our politicians don't help. On Friday, the Chancellor, Jeremy Hunt, tweeted about calls he'd had with constituents. And he ended with this anecdote. Finally, I spoke to a lady from Godalming about eligibility for the government's childcare offer, which is not available if one parent is earning over 100K. That is an issue I would really like to sort out after the next election, as I am aware that it is not a huge salary in our area if you have a mortgage to pay. Hunt was challenged about that tweet on Sky.
Do you regret tweeting that? It doesn't sound right, does it, to say £100,000 is not a huge salary?
Well, I was talking to a constituent who was pointing out to me that, you know, what sounds like a large salary, when you have house prices averaging around £670,000 in my area, if you've got a mortgage and you've got childcare costs, it doesn't go as far as you might think. And she's right. It doesn't go as far as you might think.
Now, the median salary this year, this is both full-time and part-time workers, is £28,000, right? So half the population earn less than £28,000 a year. So if someone on 100 grand is struggling, how does Hunt think the 50% of Brits earning a quarter of that are handling the cost of living crisis? Of course, no one is forced to buy a massive house, right? It's also more expensive to be a renter than paying a mortgage in this country. Now, you'd be forgiven for thinking, therefore, that Jeremy Hunt was wildly out of touch. But over on LBC, Boris Johnson's sister has done the maths. And in fact, it turns out people on 100 grand really might be struggling.
Based on your rough calculation, after that, it's about 6 grand. Minus what I've just said, you are left more or less with £2,500.
Have you taken into account, you said council tax, have you taken into account a mortgage payment there?
Yes, I have.
Okay.
I say council tax about 300, light and heat about 400, mortgage or rent about 1800.
Yeah, I think that's right. That's
house
about right.
Insurance, car insurance about 1000. Have excluded higher purchase or
hold
any
on. Car and house, sorry to be granular, but you say together car and house a month is 1000?
No. Traveling and all that, if you've got a rail card or something like that.
Oh, I see. Okay. You said insurance. That seems very high to me.
No. I'll put the insurance like £25 a month, car insurance and house insurance. I've divided it all by monthly here. So I've given you a gross figure of £1,000, including the rail card or traveling to London if you're commuting. For my calculation, I say £2,500 a month, which is left over. Now, if you...
Divide that by four. So what do we get a week? 600 quid a week?
About 600 a week, but I haven't included
in
there.
You see, that isn't very much. You are absolutely right. That is not very much.
No, it is not very much. Because why, from my experience, me and my wife, we both earn this kind of money monthly.
Both of you earn 100?
No, jointly.
Jointly, okay.
Stress the point. But it doesn't get as far. I mean, we have to think about a cheap holiday rather than an extraordinary expensive holiday.
My goodness. So the cost of living crisis is very much not over.
£600 a week. That isn't very much. I can spend that quite easily in a fancy restaurant in Soho. You know, £600, the cost of living crisis really is. People are struggling in this country, £600 a week after all of your bills and all of your essential expenditure. That's real poverty, isn't it, Ash?
I was spitting feathers, Michael, because this man said after all of his essential expenses, including food, that he had only £2,500 a month for disposable income, right? £2,500 a month disposable income. That is a lot of disposable income. That is an awful lot of disposable income. That's quite a lot to save. That's quite a lot for, what you might consider, luxury purchases, leisure activities, saving up for a holiday, especially if you've already factored in your housing costs, paying off a mortgage, which is itself an asset, which, is going to appreciate in value. Like, I'm sorry, these people are deluded. And I don't like dunking on, people who phone up, radio shows, because it's a bit like sneering at the public. The job of a journalist is to sort of introduce context which can put whatever someone is saying in perspective. The problem is that you've got a media class who are all objectively, wealthy people with secure jobs, high status, and, Rachel Johnson comes from a rich family, and they themselves have the self-perception of being hard done by. They don't think they're very rich because they're not the super rich. So if they're in the top 5, 4, maybe 3% of earners, they still feel like, I don't get to go in a private jet. So, I'm just getting by, really. You've got these people who are shaping the public discussion. So you have a completely bananas approach to thinking about personal finances and what people need. You end up with this sense of, someone who is on 80K plus is just getting by versus someone who's on benefits but has the temerity to own a smartphone is living like Rupert Murdoch. I think that this is a sort of dysfunctional narrative, which only makes sense when you look at the class composition of senior media people.
The thing I also liked about it, because I've got no idea what Rachel Johnson's journalistic background is, but sort of the way she was sort of, she had her reporter's pen out and she was sort of like, okay, so £100 for insurance. I'm just trying to be very granular here. I'm going to do this very properly. And then she concludes, £600 a week. Oh my God, how could anyone possibly survive on that? This is a very important piece of journalism I've done. Thank God I am so diligent in my role. I've written it all down. And yes, it turns out that £100,000 a year is very difficult to live on. As Ash says, the attitude is very, very different when you're talking about someone on minimum wage or someone who's on tax credits who's struggling to get by on 20 grand a year, right? It's very easy to get by on 20 grand a year. Just cook meals for 30p. That's the Lee Anderson line. But then when it comes to someone who, I suppose, you know, Rachel Johnson was thinking of that person on the call a bit like herself. And she was, when she was saying that, she was essentially saying, oh, £600 a week, I'd struggle on that, because she expects to have a different lifestyle to the vast, vast, vast majority of the country. Let's go to our final story. After Kate Middleton revealed her cancer diagnosis, it was clear there would be some bloodletting over the conspiracy theories and memes that had been swirling for the previous weeks. Who should we blame for the speculation, which, in light of Kate's actual situation, now seems rather cruel? Well, the British state and the British press has an answer.
We know that in the past, countries have tried to interfere and influence elections. Now it seems that the royal family, and in particular the Princess of Wales, have been targeted as well. Now, there's been a huge amount of support since that announcement, you're saying, on Friday. The vast majority of people in the country, vast majority of people watching, very sympathetic and very supportive to her. But in the last few weeks, we haven't just had conspiracy theories, have we? There have been very cruel and sometimes very inhumane comments. Now, some of these, it is being suggested, the worst of it may well have been originated from fake accounts, from bots, originated from propaganda machines in countries such as Russia, China, and also Iran as well.
So all those memes you saw about photoshopped photographs, all the tweets about potential royal infidelity, and all the TikToks about body doubles, those weren't just the musings of curious members of the public with too much time on their hands, but rather they were the result of malicious subversion by foreign states. It's a story that was first broken by the Daily Telegraph, who splashed it across their front page next to a picture of Kate. But is there actually any evidence for this? Well, this is what's in the Telegraph piece. So on Sunday, it emerged that there was growing concern in Whitehall that hostile state actors could be involved in whipping up the frenzied social media attacks on the princess. A government source told the Telegraph, part of the modus operandi of hostile states is to destabilize things, whether that is undermining the legitimacy of our elections or other institutions. Now, I have to say, reading this, I feel somewhat reassured. It's quite recent, sort of, that we were worried about sort of 9/11-style terror attacks or nuclear war. You know, in the Cold War, we're worried there's going to be an accidental detonation of a nuclear bomb. I mean, you know, we shouldn't necessarily be too relaxed about that now. But now, the modus operandi of our international enemies is to maybe tweet something mean about a princess. It leaves me not feeling too scared. Maybe the world isn't as dangerous as I thought it was. There's nothing more specific than that to link the current round of speculation about Kate to foreign actors. But the Telegraph did say this. Concerns have been raised in the past about suspicious bot-like Twitter accounts and handles linked to Russian conspiracy theorists that have been obsessively tweeting about the Duchess of Sussex. An analysis of accounts that together created a Meghan Markle Twitter community found that around 1,000 highly connected ones that had tweeted more than 2.5 million times over a six-month period in 2018. One account with the second highest number of pro-Meghan followers, which also tweeted about US politics from a pro-democratic perspective, appeared to indicate bot-like activity, while the fourth most shared account frequently tweeted from Russia Today and questioned Sergei Skripal's near-fatal Novichok poisoning in Salisbury in 2018. Ash, are we seeing an unholy alliance between Russia, China, Iran, and Meghan Markle fans all conspiring to bring down Britain's royal family?
I'm afraid, Michael, that we are. I have it from some very well-placed sources in Beijing that, in fact, Chinese Premier Xi Jinping was personally behind the Kate Middleton has had a Brazilian butt lift rumours. And, you know, Vladimir Putin is the one going, oh, should we drop some innuendo about Rose Hanbury, the Marchioness of Cholmondeley? I mean, this is really scraping the bottom of the barrel
from the Telegraph here, but it's something I think which is both in the British media and the British royal family's interest, because the speculation and the conspiracism was a product of poor PR from the royal family. They shared a photoshopped image. They had this bizarre narrative around Kate Middleton, including saying that she was working from home on a special project. Turns out that that special project was cancer. It was a horrible, horrible thing to say to try and distract people and, you know, get them off the scent. And in fact, it just fueled even further speculation, which I can imagine from a human level, if you're the person at the center of it, is quite horrible to experience. But that is something which has been caused by the royal family's own communication strategy. And of course, was, you know, tacitly and nudge, nudge, wink, wink, encouraged by newspapers and much of the mainstream media as well. So rather than looking at their own practices, instead, what you've got, I think, is a sort of typical blame it all on social media angle with a nice helping of geopolitical paranoia. I mean, I can believe that there are well-connected accounts which are from, you know, Russian bot farms. I can believe that. That's plausible. But that's had nothing to do with the rumor mill concerning Kate Middleton. That has all been, I'm afraid, the work of some proper cack-handed crisis management from the heart of Buckingham Palace.
I mean, this is a conspiracy theory, isn't it? I think what this misses really is that most of the speculation was quite lighthearted. Like, most of the memes were just sort of people, you know, no one really thought Kate had had a Brazilian butt lift. And, you know, I'm not sure many people really thought that the picture, that the Photoshop picture was actually superimposed from a Vogue photo shoot a couple of years earlier, right? But, you know, people wanted something to do on the internet. And now, yes, in retrospect, now we know that Kate has cancer. It does seem like it was a bit mean, right? But people didn't know that at the time. All people knew was that the royal family were doing some really bizarre things, like putting out Photoshopped images of themselves. So you know, I don't think we need to think that deeply about kind of any of this, really. Ash, on Friday, you predicted Meghan would be blamed for Kate's cancer diagnosis. Now, I always thought that was a pretty safe bet. I wouldn't have put money against that bet. And it has happened. This was the Daily Mail's Andrew Pearce interviewing the Daily Mail's Sarah Vine on GB News.
The King is struggling with his own recovery from cancer, or his treatment from cancer. Harry and Meghan?
Well, they seem to be sort of ignoring the whole thing completely, don't they? They
sent a private message.
Apparently. Yes, yeah, that's it. I mean, they really do need to apologise. Can I just say that? I mean, because
Stress is a major factor in cancer.
I mean,
stress is a major factor in cancer. Ash, there's Andrew Pearce on the money.
I mean, if anything, this was restrained from GB News. I think that they could have gone with some lashings of racial innuendo if they wanted to. You know, Meghan Markle, melanin, sounds like melanoma. Do you follow my reasoning here? I mean, they really could have gone all in. They could have said that, you know, Meghan Markle was working with, you know, Black Lives Matter, Oprah, and a Chinese manufactured ray gun to, you know, spread cancer amongst the royal family. I mean, all this stuff would be just as evidence-free as what Andrew Pearce suggested. And I think that this does show the obscenity that is British royal coverage, which is, as long as you say disgusting, you know, intrusive things with a very serious and somber and sort of superficially respectful tone, then it's fair game. But it's just as, you know, I think if in some ways it's tackier and, you know, more depraved than most of what you see going on social media, which at least has a sense of humour about it.
As I think we've made clear, that the discourse around Kate, Meghan, the royal family in general is a bit of a fact-free zone, but I was genuinely interested in the question of whether stress does cause cancer. It's something that gets said a lot. I don't think that if stress were to cause cancer, that would implicate Meghan Markle. But it's an interesting question. And this is what Cancer Research UK say on their website. No, being stressed doesn't directly increase the risk of cancer. The best quality studies have followed up many people for several years. They have found no evidence that those who are more stressed are more likely to get cancer. Some people wonder whether stress causes breast cancer, but overall, the evidence for this has been poor. And a large study of over 100,000 women in the UK in 2016 showed no consistent evidence between stress and breast cancer. Now, Cancer Research UK did sort of qualify this a bit. They said it might be the case that it can be harder for some people to keep healthy during stressful times. And if you're struggling to keep healthy, that can lead to an increased risk of cancer, i.e. stress itself doesn't cause cancer. But if stress causes you to take up smoking, or if stress stops you eating well, or I suppose potentially sleeping well, I'm not sure if a lack of sleep causes cancer. But anyway, they're sort of saying indirectly stress could. And so that does mean, you know, in Mr. Pierce's defense, if Meghan had caused Kate stress, which had then caused her to live an unhealthy lifestyle, then yes, she could have, in theory, very indirectly caused Kate to get cancer, which of course would vindicate all of the British media in their hounding of Harry and Meghan out of Britain. So fabulous journalism from GB News, as always, and from two commentators from the Daily Mail speaking to each other on, no, mainstream TV, streamed into everyone's living rooms. Ash Sarkar, it's been a very varied show. I've enjoyed it very much.
You really do get the shades of light and dark with this one, don't you?
Yes. I'm glad we had a sort of light-hearted final 20 minutes, because there were some serious topics for the rest of the show. Thanks to all of you for tuning in. Make sure to come back tomorrow at 6 p.m. You've been watching Navarra Media. Good night.
This broadcast is brought to you by Navarra Media. Go to navarramedia.com/support.